I've kept this one a little tight. The books came in last, I think last Wednesday, and but they did get here, and so I'm very good to happy to be able to introduce it to you. And in wondering how to do so, I thought, well, why don't I just read what I wrote on the little back on the back cover of this thing as a way of starting off. In the summer of 1968, a poet and minstrel from California's Big Sur country was introduced to a nationwide gathering of Unitarian Universalists at their annual meeting in Cleveland, Ohio, and Rick Maston immediately captured their hearts. He later became the Reverend Rick Maston, the one and only troubadour minister for the Unitarian Universalists. But Rick's troubadour ministry has extended far beyond any one religious denomination. His poems and songs have touched thousands of lives in many settings: churches, college campuses, high schools, grammar schools, conference centers, hospitals, nursing homes, mental health centers, prisons, and numerous other places. His hometown of Carmel, California has named him the troubadour and people's poet of Carmel. In more recent years, as Rick's personal battle with prostate cancer has become a part of his poetic ministry, the National Prostate Cancer Coalition in 2005 dubbed him the Poet Laureate of Prostate Cancer. This is the story of Rick Maston's amazing life and ministry, as told by Rick himself and a host of others who've been touched and blessed by his life and work. You may remember a couple years ago, Rick was here. It was 2 years ago this past October, and he and I got the idea for doing this book right around that time. I had just come out with that book I did on beat spirituality called The Beat Face of God, and as Rick and I talked about that, the idea of doing a book about his somewhat beat, somewhat hippie, a little bit of everything kind of a life came working into our conversation, so 2 years later, we got this done. In about 6 or 7 weeks, I'll be joining Rick in Carmel for a series of weekend events that are being planned there, both by the Monterey Arts Council and by the Monterey Carmel Union Church, to pay a tribute to Rick, and I'm going to be very pleased, looking forward to going out there and to being a part of that, and to hopefully move a few books as well. It really has been a joy to work on this thing, especially the times that I was spent, sometimes with Michelle, sometimes by myself, with Rick and Billy Barbara Maston at their home in the Big Sur Hills. But the past couple of months, going back to last summer as we gave it its finishing touches, did have a bittersweet tone to them. The sweet part is the sense of accomplishment and getting something out and done. The downside is that Rick's prostate cancer has flared up again. He had to go on another round of chemotherapy, and that got complicated by various other kinds of complications that I don't even understand all that well. But the good news to the bad is that he came through all that, and he's feeling re-energized and is actually booking a few tours again in near where he lives. He had originally planned back in the spring to come east again. We were actually planning an event where he could be back here to introduce the book, but with his health being what it was, that did not happen. The other more recent challenge for him is that his wife of 55 years is now experiencing dementia. She has very kind of short-term memory. So between Rick dealing with his prostate cancer and Billy Barber's dementia, it's a very challenging time for them. Two of their daughters and one of their sons does live very close by. So while my thoughts and prayers and best wishes are with Rick and Billy, and I'm looking forward to seeing both of them in a couple of months, my joy is that we got this story told while it could still be told. And it's quite a story. As you caught the little blurb there, back in the mid-1960s, a guy in his somewhere mid to late 30s at that time was trying to make it as a poet and a songwriter and kind of a folkie, and he and his wife happened upon and joined the Unitarian Universalist Church in Carmel, California. I tell that story, I think I used that story in a sermon several weeks back about how they found the church, and that's in here. And after he got into the church, he becomes discovered, as it were, by some local Unitarian Universalists who also had some denominational clout. And within a few years, they were able to work it out so he could become this kind of a circuit-riding poet, troubadour to Unitarian Universalists across the country. It was very different. The UU ministry at that time was a very different tone to it than it did now. It was practically all men, just a very few women. And it was had very much a kind of intellectualized flavor to it, and sort of this kind of beat hippie poet walking into congregations and singing the kind of songs that the band had already sung, and reading some of his poems was very much of a change of pace for UUs in those days. But they liked it. In fact, they liked it so much they decided that what Rick was doing was a ministry, and they were going to make him a minister. He had no college degree. In fact, he flunked out of four colleges and dropped out of a fifth. So he had no college degree, much less a seminary education. And so, but our ministerial fellowship committee gave him ministerial standing anyway, with the understanding that he would never take a church, that he had to keep doing what he was which he was quite happy, to do. And so, as they sit in that back cover blur of his life and poet as a songwriter and performer, however, ended up going well beyond UU circles into some of those various and sundry areas that I named. And then, following his initial prostate cancer diagnosis in 1999, Rick took on what he calls, and what we titled one of the chapters in here, the ministry I've been preparing for all my life, as he's reaching out through his website and other appearances to battlers and survivors of prostate cancer and their families. So it's been quite a life all the way through that he has had. And how to tell that story was really the first real challenge I hit up against. And how do I put this thing together? Because once I had gathered all the data I could gather by going around interviewing people who have known him at different points in his life and soliciting sort of information through various email channels that I had, and getting letters, and I even got a few big packets of Rick Nasty memorabilia that people who have been following his career for years have been keeping kind of in the back of a file drawer somewhere, I guess hoping someone like me would eventually one of these days come along who could use the stuff. So I had all this material, and I said, okay, now how do you write a book with this? And I decided I really didn't, I didn't want to do just a straight kind of life and times of Rick Mastin biography, although I wanted to cover that, but I didn't want to just write it that way. I didn't quite want to go to some of the exotic lengths. I don't know if you've seen the movie yet, Dan. There's a new movie on Bob Dylan out now. I haven't seen it, but in reviews, you've got like six different people playing six different versions of Bob Dylan at six different times in his life using six different names. I didn't quite want to get that exotic with it either when it came to telling Rick's story. So I thought, well, why don't I at least write about something that I think I know something about, which is ministry, since that's what I've been doing for all of my adult life. So I decided I'd write a book about ministry and what it means to be in ministry and what the various modes and meanings that ministry takes on. And I wanted to write it both for clergy and lay people alike. So I decided what I would do was to use Rick Mastin's ministry, this alternative, poetic, countercultural, let's say, sort of beat hippie type of a ministry, and I would use that to explore the many meanings of ministry itself. So we've got chapters in here titled The Minister Poet as Pastor, The Minister Poet as Prophet. Prophet is someone who stands for social justice. The Minister Poet as Theologian, The Minister Poet as Colleague. And then we got into a couple chapters that deal with the very tricky issue of how much self-disclosure, how much of him or herself, how much of their personal life does a minister bring in to their ministry. In this vein, we have a chapter called The Minister Poet, How Exposed and Vulnerable, and one just called Family Matters. It deals with some of the very difficult at times family dynamics that Rick was dealing with his wife and their three daughters and one son, a son who has battled and fortunately now has come out of it, so battling various forms of addiction for much of his life. So the question was, how much of his personal life did he bring into his kind of poetic minister life? One of the poems in here, I'm probably not going to have time to read, but it's called The Bixby Bridge Incident, where Rick recounts a time when he actually, in a very low, depressive state, actually considered taking a leap off what's the Bixby Canyon Bridge in Big Sur, which is this huge, high bridge, which you go over the edge of that and you're done. And he wrote a poem about what he was thinking about as he was considering that and how he came out of it and decided to choose life again and to go on living. It's an interesting, it's a good poem, I thought. He ended up reading it at some of his early appearances when he was kind of on the UU minister circuit. And this idea of self-disclosure in a pulpit was not as widely accepted even in UU circles then as it is now. And it nearly costed his standing with the Unitarian Universalists for reading that poem. He had to go back before the Ministerial Fellowship Committee and defend his use of it so he could continue on. We got a whole chapter just on that whole incident and the kind of issues that it raises about how, as I say, how exposed and vulnerable a minister is to be. Because as a poet, you're kind of expected to sort of put it all out there. In fact, one of Rick's collections of poems is called Stark Naked. And he chose that title because that is, you know, you kind of put yourself out there. But then when you're a minister, as I think I put it, I said, you know, maybe the poet can, metaphorically speaking, stand stark naked before his hearers, but a minister is expected to have at least a few articles of clothing on him. You know, and how do you balance that off? So we devote a couple of chapters to that issue. And then, as I said, we took a chapter and just wrote about strictly about his prostate cancer odyssey and how he's dealt with that and how that's become a part of his ministry, as I say, is reaching out to any number of people, both by his website and personal appearances, offering comfort and support and encouragement to both battlers of cancer and to their families. So we did a whole chapter on that one. And then we did one that we call Ministry Beyond the Ministry, which is about all the other areas of Rick's life where he has taken his poems and his songs beyond his UU minister hat, about some of the other hats that he has worn. So it was a lot of fun and not a little bit of work pulling all that together, but we did get it done. One thing I felt especially good about was that we were able to get the actress, activist, poet, and performer, and wife of the late Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee, to write the foreword to the book. And people see that and they say, "How did you get Ruby Dee to write the foreword to this book?" And my answer is because I caught up to her one day when she was walking down the street in Milford, New Hampshire. Quick story on that, but if I can do it quickly. A couple of years ago, if you've been to Milford, one of their parks there, they have a statue of an African-American woman named Harriet Wilson. She is believed to be the first African-American woman to publish a novel in the United States, and she's from Milford, and her novel is about her life as an indentured servant in Milford after the Civil War. And so they had this big effort in Milford to honor her memory and put a statue to her in a park, and they got Ruby Dee to come up when they had the commemoration and dedication of the statue. So I went to the event, and I think some of you were probably there as well, packed into the town hall there in Milford, and Ruby Dee comes up, all 80-some years of her, just barrel of energy, and does her presentation. Then we had to walk to the park where the statue was going to be, unveiled. And the interesting thing was, a couple of months before, I had been doing one of my series of interviews with Rick, and he had told me his story about how he had met Ruby Dee at a restaurant in Harlem sometime back in the mid-70s when she had contacted him about using some of his poems in some kind of a Broadway review thing that she was doing. So just being kind of brazening it out, I guess, I just saw her walk. I was walking to the park, and I noticed she and one other woman who was in charge of the program were about 20 feet behind me, so I just turned around and walked up and introduced myself and told her I was a friend of Rick Mastin, and she picked right up on that immediately and asked me how he was doing, and we sort of walked down the street talking about Rick for several blocks, and I went home and called Rick about it and got her address and some correspondence. She ended up writing the foreword. I'm going to read just a little bit of her foreword, and then I'm going to read a few other passages from the book as well. This is part of Ruby's foreword. "I count among my treasured books a copy of Speaking Poems, signed by Rick when we first met in Harlem almost 30 years ago. It's like those I've collected since, dog-eared and starred with favorites, some of which you'll find woven into the story of Rick's life, which you hold in your hands now. You'll be delighted that Steve Eddington has captured in these pages the spirit that has enabled Rick to triumph time and again and coax us out of our comfort zones and into the mirror for a good look at ourselves. It is this spirit that enables Rick, even now, to live life to the last drop. I can't imagine the end of Rick Mastin. We who know and love him, and countless new ones of us waiting in the wings, will forever ride the wave of his words he has given us to sing and say out loud, even to ourselves. How wonderful to have this book as a companion and context. Ossie and I never made it to Big Sur, but I imagine guitars, the four of us sitting under the majestic sky, talking, laughing, singing, shouting out new mind equations. I know Ossie would be as impressed as I am with this telling of Rick's story, this magic lens on his life and love and poetry in divine motion and joy. I was very honored to have her write that piece to introduce the book. Well, I'm gonna just read a few passages. We can shadow them more in copy hour as you like, and I did bring some along in case you'd like to take one home to you. See my wife Michelle for that, for my agent or over here. The first chapter, the opening chapter of this, I titled The Rainbow's End Truck Stop. And I used the poem I read for the chalice lighting to introduce it. And then these are the opening paragraphs. To arrive at Rick and Billy Barber Mastin's home is to feel like you've come about as close to the end of the rainbow as you'll ever get or want to. The last mile, if you're driving it, is not a ride for the faint-hearted. Once you make the left off the paved road by a long row of mailboxes, you're navigating a very narrow strip of dirt, gravel, and ruts with no guardrail. The best way to manage it is to inhale at the mailboxes and exhale when you pull into the Mastin driveway. But the view is worth the drive. The vista from Rick's weather-worn deck, as you look across the Big Sur Mountains, on out to a little blue spot of the Pacific Ocean, has a certain zen-like aura to it. In a single moment, you feel like you've seen all you need to see to make your life complete. It's the way the world at its best is supposed to look. This has been Rick Mastin's home from the time he was just a bit of a ways beyond the kid of 20 he writes about in his poem. And whether he's ready to acknowledge it or not, Rick has now become that old guru up on the mountain himself. The vista from Shea Mastin is a little like the view Rick now has of the unfolding of our liberal religious movement. It's the mountaintop view of our liberal religious movement as it has played out over the last four decades. By his own estimate, Rick has come off this mountain enough times to appear in over 500 UU congregations, as well as at several general assemblies, and the various other UU gatherings and conferences, far too numerous to name or recall. He has also cultivated relationships with scores of UU clergy during that time, as his life has intersected with theirs in some very meaningful and humorous and often poignant ways. He's done all this with his guitar over his shoulder, with a sheaf of poems in hand, and a store of stories in his head. And always, his playful and sometimes rascal-like self. But like any good playful rascal, Rick does not come down from his mountain just to play and be rascal-like. He comes to challenge, to provoke, to amuse, to soothe, to startle, and even at times to generate a little anger. Rick Mastin has been the one and only Unitarian Universalist Troubadour minister. For all of his travels, his many roads have always in time wound back to the home on the mountainside, a ways up Palo Colorado Canyon, on the northern end of California's Big Sur country. It is now time to take some measure. Not just the measure of Rick's life, but the measure of life of this small but persistent religious liberal movement that he and I and so many of our colleagues and lay people have dedicated so much of our lives to. And then it kind of goes from there. I'm going to read. Find a poem that I got a good kick out of, and then I'm going to have Ben come up and sing another song for you. This is in the chapter called The Minister Poet as Prop, where we talked about what it means to bring your poetic self into a prophetic kind of ministry. Rick, a very strong peace advocate, social justice, racial advocate, but also he had a way of trying to bring people together who were on who were on different places with the issue. He didn't just be an advocate, he tried to be a catalyst to get people who maybe had different opinions or different feelings about an issue, trying to help them find a way to talk to one another. This is a poem where he pokes a little fun at himself. It's called When Giants Pass. By a route too circuitous to detail, I came around the close, dusky atmosphere of Bethel Baptist, abruptly aware of surroundings minus the glare of light off white skin, feeling conspicuous, unable to conform, I bob on the surface of a dark, moist, murmuring warren. What the visiting preacher said there that evening remains a blur, yet I vividly recall the shoe being on the other foot, and exactly where, in that packed assembly hall, the other two white faces were. Afterward, at the reception, I observed the guest of honor being shyly avoided. No one goes near him at all. He stands alone, looking tired and incredibly small. So I go up to the man and in a well-meaning, good-natured, show business way, clap him on the back and say, "Working you pretty hard, aren't they?" I still can't believe I said that to Martin Luther King. And neither could he. Looking up sharply at such a blatant display of naivete. Then, with patience and remarkable grace, said simply, "Yes, but it's worth it." That's just a flavor of his poetry. The guy is absolutely wonderful. I'm going to have Dan come back up. One of the poems he wrote was called "Think of Me as Music," and although he wrote it in one way, he wrote it for a particular person or a particular special person in his life, but he says he also wrote it for all the people who had been a part of any of his performances where he would kind of come in and do it and move on. So Dan's going to sing that, and I'm going to come back and read the story about how he came to write the poem "Let It Be a Dance," and then we'll sing that together as well. So this is "Think of Me as Music."
I can't resist a short note with this one. None of us have ever actually heard this song. The only way we have it is through some printed music, which itself is a transcription of Rick's song by someone else. So we hope it comes out somewhat like how he intended it. Song, get it on, then be gone again. So I think I'm gonna change my name and call myself a song.
Song, I wanted to read the story of how he came to Rhode, and it's very, as you'll see, has a rather sad and quite tragic dimension to it, but also rather, in some ways, victorious one as well. An earlier part in the book, I used some of reflections by John Burens, our former UUA president, who had known Rick pretty well, and John cites the line that another of our colleagues, Reverend Forrest Church, has used quite often, where he says, "Religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die." To phrase it in a slightly different way, religion is how we say yes to life in the face of the reality and inevitability of death. Theology is the language we use. Inadequate as it is, theology is the language we use, inadequate as it always will be, in giving voice to that yes. The story of how Rick came to write his signature song and work, "Let It Be a Dance," is really a working out of this understanding of religion and theology. Here is Rick telling it in his own words. "It was one of those horrendous tragedies that happened in the American high schools every 4 or 5 years. This particular incident took place one December at Carmel High School. A first-year teacher offered a course on modern dance and had 14 young men and women performing like Broadway professionals. My two oldest daughters, Jerry and April, took the class and were a regular part of the troupe. During the Christmas vacation, the teacher saw a famous ensemble out of New York City was performing in San Jose. She called up all her students and said if they were willing to be crowded during the journey, they could go to San Jose in her VW bus. Both of my daughters wanted to go in the worst way, but had other holiday arrangements scheduled. As the carload of dancers was rounding a corner on the way home, a drunk driver who had pulled over to the side of the road decided to pull back onto the highway without looking behind him. The VW bus crashed headlong into his car, killing the two front seat passengers, one of whom was the teacher. All the other girls and boys in the back seats were seriously injured. One of those injured was Barbara Broussel, my daughter Jerry's best friend at the time. Barbara's kneecap was so badly damaged the doctor doubted if she would ever walk again without a cane, let alone dance again. My family and I visited Barbara in the hospital where I made a bet with her. I wagered that she would come dancing up our Big Sur dirt road exactly 1 year from that day. And what's more, I would write the music she would be dancing to. The following week, while working in my garden, the entire song arrived. I ran to the house and wrote the lyrics down as fast as I could type. Better still, the words came with a melody. Barbara Broussel, now a well-known cabaret singer in New York City, did come dancing up our country road exactly a year to the day after the accident, with me singing and playing Let It Be a Dance. Barbara was limping, it's true, but dancing. The image and reality of the dance has become the anchoring metaphor for Rick's ministry. It is an affirmation of the enduring power of the life spirit, even in the face of death. Unitarian Universalists do not have an established creed and do not read from a prayer book in their worship. And yet this affirmation of faith is repeated whenever Unitarian Universalists, and the hymn is now in a Lutheran hymnal as well, whenever Unitarian Universalists turn to hymn number 311 and sing this song. The song is Let It Be a Dance, and Jed and Dan are going to lead us in. Number 311.